This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Friday today. I have said it's Thursday today for years. Years. And the day is gorgeous. The day is just gorgeous. But it's just warm enough in the car. I'm going to turn up the air conditioning a little bit. Because I have multiple layers on today because it's Star Wars Day. It's not actually Star Wars Day. I know that. I know May the 4th be with you is actual Star Wars Day. But, you know, it's Friday. This is the Friday before Star Wars Day. So it's Star Wars Day to me. So it's been fun today. You know, had a lot of smiles, had a lot of laughs. Got two of those snap reactions where someone is working on something, and so then I just kind of walk up into their vicinity with social distancing and just stand there and look at them and just wait. Not move, just wait. Because what that does is that people are used to identifying threats through movement. And so, or not just threats, but different experiences through movement. So they're used to an introduction of a new player. So out of the corner of their eye, they catch someone walking up. Well, if someone is concentrating and they're not paying attention, you're out of their peripheral vision. You can walk up and you can take a spot and just stand there and wait. And then what happens is their peripheral vision doesn't necessarily pick you up because you're not moving. And when they turn their head there, then it's like you suddenly appear. So I had a couple of those today. So those are fun because there's a sudden shock. And then of course they're looking at a guy, you know, wearing an R2-D2 bodysuit. And a tutu, and, you know, various other paraphernalia. And there's the sudden recognition that it's Phil, because these were both people that I knew. And so between those two things, you usually get a pretty happy reaction. And I did. There was laughter. There was busting out in laughter. And telling the one lady that it happened to, another friend came up, and she was talking to her, and she said, I was just working on this thing, and I turned around, and he was just there. So it's fun. It's fun. You know, bring a few smiles. So things are starting to open up, which is good. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out now. And when the surge comes, which there will be a surge of infections, I mean, it's... When the surge comes, it'll be interesting to see how the government responds. I'm glad I'm not having to make the decision. I did meet a buddy today in Walmart who apparently did have COVID-19. You know, went through the whole illness, quarantined, blah, blah, blah. So he's back. But I asked him, I said, so how was it? Because he's... I'd say he's probably mid-40s, maybe. And he said it was like the worst cold you've ever had times 10. He said that, I asked him, you know, do you have trouble breathing? He said, well, I did. He said, I was short of breath, couldn't breathe. And, short of breath. He didn't say anything about being hospitalized or anything like that. So, again, there's just, everybody responds a little different to it. He's back. You know, he looks fine. We do have a dear, dear friend who is older. They're late 70s, who is older. And it had gone through their church. They had a child evangelist in who had it. That's one of those sad, sad stories. And, you know, was in there for a series of meetings. And, of course, you know, everybody does, it's before everybody starts getting concerned and starts... Oh, I'm putting on my watch upside down. I took off my gloves and then I looked down because I was putting on my watch and it kept saying 6:15. I thought, 6:15? How can it be 6:15? It's actually 12:15. I was just confused there for a minute, but now I'm back. Actually, it would be 6:45. No, what did... yeah, 6:45. Anyways, so we do have a dear friend in Arkansas who had their church, a lot of people in the church had gotten infected. They had come down with it, and now he's just had a stroke as well, which my wife tells me is one of those sort of follow-on things that happened. So it's, I'm glad I'm not making these decisions, because there are many, many difficult decisions here, and people tend to find things to be irate about from a very simplistic viewpoint, because it's not really about the difficulty of the problem they're facing or the difficulty of the problem that we are all facing. It's simply about they are being inconvenienced and someone should fix it. I was talking to one of my friends in Walmart and I said, so how's it going? You guys, you know, and she kind of rolled her eyes a little bit. She said, yeah, she said, it's a little rough some days. She said, but it's mostly, it's, she said, it's the customers that, you know, get irate about things. She said, I just dealt with one who was mad because the self-checkout aisles weren't open. And she said, I told him, I'm sorry, we don't have the staff for it. Because they're doing so much online grocery picking stuff at this point, she said, you should hire some more people. She said, well, we're trying to hire more people. She said, if you'd be willing to come work for us, we will give you a job. Which this is an interesting combination of things, because first of all, the government threw a whole bunch of people out of work by closing everything down. Then they gave, to make up for that, they gave those people extra money. And then, you know, they give small businesses loans provided they keep people on the payroll. And one of my friends in Walmart I was talking to, he said his son, or it was a close relative, I think maybe his son, had just gotten this, you know, brand new, well, not brand new, but this cool car, and he said it cost $6,000, and he said, I asked him, I said, where in the world did you get the money? He said, well, I've got unemployment. And my buddy in Walmart, he said, do you know how much they're paying him in unemployment? I said, well, it's a lot. He said, he's making $800 a week. He said, $3,200 a month he's making on unemployment. I said, yeah, I know. I'm glad I'm not making all these decisions. Because side effects, consequences, lots and lots and lots of them. But you know what? Things are moving along. And here in Missouri, we are starting to open back up. They're still asking people to social distance. They have limited still any kind of meeting per se, any kind of gathering of people to 15, which, of course, knocks out any kind of church potential till the end of May, at least. But, you know, we are right here at the 1st of May, and, you know, step at a time. So, that's all fine. I'm puttering along on book 13. That all seems to be going fine. I'm getting to that stage where I'm like, okay, so let's find a plot. I know kind of where the plot is on this one, but of course there's always just a ton of details between here and there. But it's always amazing to me because it all just works out. It just works out. I just keep writing and it works out. And even when the first 8 books, I was amazed at how that once I got to book 8 and I was wrapping up a bunch of the themes, I can't say that I actually sat down and figured it all out, but as I was writing book eight, I thought, okay, that really makes it sound like I planned this. Which I did not. But there was, that was interesting. So I'm going to be interested to see if book 16 ends up the same way. Book 16, you know, it's going to be the big dramatic book. Mainly because in the first set of eight, I did a penultimate book, book 7. I made that like the big thing. I mean, book 7 was not supposed to end where it ended. It was supposed to end on a little lighter note, but book 7 ends really dark. And book 7 is very heavy and difficult to read. And I did not intend it to be that dark when I was writing it, but I needed to be true to the story. So I stuck with that, and I was true to the story. I did dial some stuff back because I just thought, well, okay, that's too much. But I felt like I was true to the story. But that meant I ran out of pages, is what happened. But that meant some really key plot points that would have lightened up the whole story disappeared from book 7 and ended up in book 8. And I lost beta readers over book 7. I did, which was fine. You know, it's always an honor and a privilege when people will take the time to read my stuff. But there were some things that needed to be said in book 7, and I said them. So book 7, though, part of my justification for allowing that is that book 7 was the cliffhanger. So then book 8 was the end of the first cycle. So that all worked out fine. Well, now that I'm heading toward, I'm on the downside, wait, book, yeah, 9, 10, 11, 12, right. This, I'm on 13 right now, which is on the downside of the next set of 8 books. I'm thinking about shape, and I'm thinking about, okay, so what happens in book 15? Is it the same as the type of flavor that's in book 7? And I decided that no, it wasn't, because the second set is like the penultimate set for the series, because there's 3 sets of 8 books in the series. And so book 8, the second set of 8 books really needs to end with the last book being the big cliffhanger, because it's that last book, book 16, where you've got to introduce everything that's going to drive you into the last set of 8 books. So I'm holding, you know, my ammunition in reserve. I'm holding the big stuff in reserve for book 16, and we'll just coast through book 15 at this point. So it's fun, but I'm on 13, which means I only have this one and then 3 more to go. Second set of 8 books will be done, which just seems astonishing. It's just astonishing. I have had a little side project this week. I may have mentioned that I'm working on a costume for Mother's Day, which I Oh, man. I got this idea. I ran it past my wife. She agreed to it. So I've been working on that in the evenings as well. So it's been a little... Things have been a little busy. Things have just been a little busy. But that's okay. We're getting everything done. And my wife is healing up nicely. So, yay. You know, she had a little rough night last night. Her hands were really burning last night. But she'd had a bunch of dead skin. And I think she cleaned some of that off because it looked better. But then the skin underneath wasn't quite ready yet. And so then it got angry. Thankfully, we still have some, you know, pain meds and stuff, and so she went ahead and took something a little heavier last night just to get her through until that skin kind of toughens up a little bit. It's amazing. It's amazing how much those skin abrasions can hurt, you know, like paper cuts and those sorts of things. So Anyways, so all is well. All is well. God is good. He's kind. He holds our future. You know, he holds our future. And we can trust in him. I came across an article that I thought, oh, this is interesting. And it's just, the article really is not very long. I might just read the article because it's not very long, but it's just, it's so fascinating to me how people's preconceptions kick in and how, so the article is Volcanic Rock Discovery Calls Theories About Life's Origins Into Question. So talks about the fact that Charles Darwin, the father of evolutionary biology, wrote in 1871 that life first emerged in warm little ponds. And he imagined there were small wells surrounded by rocks and air that had chemicals in them, heated by the sun. And, you know, just a little randomness and magic, presto, life begins. Which, of course, no one has actually explained that yet, how magic, presto, they jostle a bunch of stuff around and come up with precursors of proteins and then say, see, there it is. Yeah, except, yeah, I've done a podcast on the mathematical improbability of even getting one protein built randomly. But anyways, so the article goes on to say, these days, scientists generally agree with the idea that the original recipe for life was pretty simple, but they're not sure what the ingredients were necessary to make those early life forms leap into complex forms like animals. Many scientists theorize, since all complex life involving cells that have multiple components now rely on oxygen to breathe, it must have happened sometime between, at a time when there was plenty of oxygen to breathe. But scientists behind a 2018 study published in Nature report that oxygen levels in the atmosphere didn't rise to significant levels until after complex life arose, suggesting oxygen wasn't that important after all. Quote, this is significant because it provides new evidence that the origin of early animals, which required O2 in their metabolisms, may have gone in and on in a world with an atmosphere that had relatively low oxygen levels compared to today, says study co-author Daniel Stolper, PhD, an assistant professor of Earth and Planetary Science at the University of California, Berkeley, in a statement. In previous studies, scientists determined that complex life first emerged around 700 to 800 million years ago, somewhere between huge ice ages. The study of oxygen on Earth, meanwhile, is a bit cloudier. Scientists believe there was no oxygen for Earth's first 2 billion years, then some 2.3 to 2.5 billion years ago, a little bit of oxygen showed up. Then they tell that because of the rust. They start finding rocks that are red with a rust-like compound, and you need oxygen for rust. But deposits of fossilized charcoal have shown that it wasn't until at least 400 million years ago that there was enough oxygen in the atmosphere for forest fires to burn. That leaves a 2.1 billion year period during which there was minimal oxygen in the atmosphere, but strangely, still evidence of life. And the idea here is that if you have animals in all of the animal kingdom, with the exception of a very few little one-cell organisms, I think they are bacteria something. If you have animals that all require oxygen, all of them require oxygen, then you would expect, if you didn't have oxygen when they got started, you would expect that they would die, for one thing, but that they certainly wouldn't prefer oxygen over other gases in terms of finding a way to metabolize it. Anyways, at one point in those 2.1 billion years, the geochemists showed that the amount of oxygen in the air reached a concentration high enough that it led to the deep sea becoming oxygenated sometime between 540 and 420 million years ago. They came to this conclusion by looking at the rocks formed by undersea volcanoes, in particular the iron inside them. So they're looking for rust, is what they're looking for. And so you've got to get the deep seas oxygenated enough that rocks can rust, and then you can date the rocks, etc. More importantly, it also became clear that complex life had existed on Earth long before the oxygenation of the sea took place. This finding complicates matters for researchers trying to figure out when complex life on Earth emerged. Especially since those who believe that since all life breathes oxygen, the event was inextricably linked to oxygenation of the atmosphere. Since now that doesn't seem to be the case, scientists must think on different theories, like the one posited by scientists in Nature in 2017, suggesting that the explosion of complex life coincided not with a rise in oxygen, but with the first big bloom in algae growth. The more we learn about the origin of life, both simple and sophisticated, the more puzzling life seems to be. In some ways, it doesn't seem to be very complex at all. What? For the most part, scientists pondering the mystery of life origins still think along the same lines as Stewart, proposing that the original recipe wasn't very complicated at all. Perhaps it could have been cooked up some other place than Earth. This is the whole, well, we can't figure it out, so we'll just say it happened someplace else. Someplace other than Earth. Paul Niles, for one, a planetary geologist with NASA investigating the possibility that life could have emerged on Mars, said in a statement in October that sometimes life doesn't need a nice atmosphere, temperate surface, just heat, rocks, and water. Oh, really? Oh, really? Since abundant oxygen doesn't seem to be at all that necessary for simple life to develop into something more, now there's an even greater possibility that complexity exists someplace. So I just love the fact that we've got this theory that we all breathe oxygen, and therefore we probably had a high oxygen content in our atmosphere when life got all started, because that seems reasonable. Now we say, well, no, it didn't. Then we say, well, okay, so it must develop simpler than that. Not that, okay, maybe someone else started it here, you know. Ugh. And then we get into these simplistic statements like, well, life isn't that complicated, we'll just do this. But, you know, we're still in these three waves of science, and we'll just wait to see how things move forward. There's some really great stuff by a really interesting scientist. I wish I had his name. I don't have his name because I'm just driving along I'm home now. Just driving along my car. But he is a Christian, plus he's a nanoscience researcher and molecular biologist and really, really smart guy, has lots of businesses. And he starts going through what you need for life. Not only what you need for a nucleus, but what you need for the complex carbohydrate shell on the outside in order to get everything and get it packaged up and get it protected from the environment and the chemistry involved. And it's just astonishing. He just says, there's just no way. There's no way this is simple, and there's no way it just pops out. But, you know, hope springs eternal for those who are trying to prove there is no God and that humans are not special. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.